Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Frank McGuinness, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brendan.
Frank, you're a playwright and a poet and an author, but today we're going to talk about music because you've chosen five songs that have meant something to you throughout your life. And you've dabbled a bit in music as well, haven't you? You've done a bit of opera, you've collaborated with people like Marianne Faithfull.
Yes.
You love music, do you?
I do, actually, yeah. I mean, it was certainly the earliest attempts at writing were lyrics because it was the easiest to do and it was what was surrounding me at the time. So I tried to write songs. The problem was I couldn't play a musical instrument, so there were songs without music. Okay. And I would hum and ha and diddly-da, but nobody really took me up on it, so they sat there silently. And maybe just as well, there is no record of them.
The silent lyrics. You know, most people, when we do this slot with them, they talk about the music at home coming from like sessions in the house or maybe pirate radio late at night or their parents' record collections. Yeah. Very refreshingly, I've seen you credit television, the much maligned idiot box, which your early cultural education.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. TV, the great educator, the real educator.
Yeah, really,
certainly
yeah.
Better than the ones we had in school, actually.
Yeah, so tell us.
Well, no, Buncrana up in the north was so close to Derry. And we had BBC from about 1957, 58. And, you know, I can remember children's programmes, Watch My Mother and things like that. But, I mean, my mother and father were glued to Miss World 1958 and the Eurovision Song Contest, Pearl Kyle and Teddy Johnson. And those things really made an impact on me. But also, I mean, they were the... Those programmes were the source for, you know, giving me access to mythology and to literature. They taught me an awful lot, actually, TV programmes.
Yeah.
So I'm immensely grateful to them, and particularly to the BBC, which was a real, real programme maker then.
Did you see the first ever Top of the Pops as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
1964, Dusty was there.
Yeah.
We can't say it anymore. Jimmy Savile introduced it. Okay. I think that's why they don't show it anymore.
Yeah.
But Dusty was in there doing his number, actually. The Beatles were number one. I can't remember what it was. Might have been I Feel Fine. But there it was. I was coming up.
So you must have never seen anything like this, had you?
Well, yes, I had, actually. I mean, there were plenty of great pop programmes. Ready, Steady, Go was
okay,
the real revelation.
Yeah.
And Thank Your Lucky Stars. But Top of the Pops was, you know, the Bible, and that was it.
So your first music choice then, tell me about the impact the Beatles has exploding into the life of a young lad in Buncrana in the 60s.
I cannot explain to you the liberation it brought, actually. And I kind of date my childhood from hearing them and my response to them, because I invented this whole world where I was like their best friend. I mean, the Beatles were all mates of mine, and I had a whole character for each of them, and I was closer to some rather than the other. But I had this fantasy world where, you know, we were all having adventures together and, you know, doing mad things together as 10-year-olds.
And what was it about them that was different from the other bands around at the time?
Oh, I think it was just, they were up for anything, and they had great, couldn't give a damn, really, actually. I mean, and that kind of anarchy of them at the time, actually, was so wonderful. And that great music, even as a 10-year-old, you knew you were being subjected to something truly liberating, truly new.
And the first song you chose is I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah.
Why this?
It's the first time I really felt what a love song could be. And I was in love with all of them, particularly with Paul.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I would have held anything of Paul's, you know, let alone his hand.
Really? Okay. Let's have a listen to Frank McGuinness's first choice, The Beatles, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
I can hide, I can hide, I can hide.
That's Frank McGuinness's first choice today, The Beatles, and I Want to Hold Your Hand. Listening to it there, it's an extraordinary thing. They were knocking out albums of that kind of stuff in a week, like, back then.
Yeah, practically, And also, I mean, it was the song of the time, actually. It was a time of terrible fear in this country as well as everywhere else. I mean, church held sway. Teachers could be a nightmare. The terrible crisis of the day, Kennedy being shot. And, within like months of that happening, they were singing, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Optimism.
And up it went. America was ready for them. America embraced them, obviously.
Yeah.
But Ireland did as well, actually. I think we're very proud of the fact that so many of them had Irish connections, and maybe even one of them might have been a Catholic, you know, but a lapsed one, an ideal one. But that they were the great bringers of hope, the great bringers of change.
And there's hearing in what you were saying before we played the song as well. Was there a sense of a sexual awakening for you as well with them? Yeah.
I don't think so. I think I was too young. I mean, it might have happened, but I was 10.
Yeah.
And I mean, believe me, I wasn't precocious enough to be on the line about that. But I mean, they were beautiful. They were absolutely beautiful, the four of them. And, together, they were just orgasmic, actually. Yeah. So what can you say? Of course, there has to have been. And if you look at the audiences, these girls are going crazy, but half the audiences are boys, and they're going crazy as well.
Yeah.
So they brought great happiness to many.
And what were you like as a kid, and what was growing up in Buncrana like?
Well, it was a tough town, northern.
And were you a tough boy?
No.
No.
Absolutely not. No, I was a battle, as they say. You know
what
I mean? In Donegal term, a battle. Me and Neil McCafferty were two self-confessed battles.
Which was,
if there's a battle, you run or you hide.
Okay.
You know, I think Neil spent most of the riots hidden in a bin. You know, and I wasn't there for the riots, but I would have been in the bin with her. So we were two certified battles.
Yeah.
I was always very frightened of physical violence. And growing up at that time, there was an awful lot of, from school there was violence, and from other pupils there was violence. And I was, I lived in perpetual fear of that, actually. There's no question of that. So anything like
were you a lonely kid?
No, I was the eldest boy in a very big extended family, but all the rest were girls. Eventually I had a sister 5 years down the line and a brother 5 years down the line. But I spent a lot of time in my childhood on my own. I mean, I was a real loner. I had mates. I had good pals who are still around, actually. And, we went to school together, but I really was not terribly happy or at peace with other people's company.
Did that change?
It did to some extent. I learned to be more sociable. I learned to be less frightened. But I never could tell, because of Buncrana, it's an emotional town. It's a physically fraught town. And things can change terribly easily. So I never felt secure in company. And as I got older, I think I learned to read situations better and I got more confident. But I was up until today, I'm still nervy and
expecting
strangers.
The worst.
More or less, yeah.
Yeah. You grew up, there were a lot of strong women in the family.
Very
people
much
will
so.
Know your play Factory Girls and that. But I think that shapes a person in a certain way, whether they grow up in a kind of a place dominated by matriarchy, in a household dominated by matriarchy or patriarchy, does it?
Oh, there's no question of that, actually. I mean, the woman on my father's side, the woman on my mother's side, they were immensely able, immensely courageous. And looking back on it now, I think they were also immensely angry because they really should have had opportunities that were not given to them by church or state. And I think that that anger communicated itself in the extent of their ambition for their children and their determination that their children would take every possible, exploit every possible chance to get on, to do things.
Because we all know women from that generation and subsequent generations for a while, these bright, smart, strong women who never got any chance in life. Like, that's hard for your mother, wasn't it?
It was like desperately tough, actually. I mean, John B. Keane had, in Big Maggie, he had a description of them as Amazons of women. And these Amazons of women were forced into, you know, working as shirt factory workers or cleaners or, you know, shop assistants. And I mean, the hard fact was they could have run the business, they could have run the factory, given the opportunity. But it wasn't there. One of the worst stories of my mother ever told me was when she was 14, after having been, you know, quite a robustious student and a bright student, having to go in at the day on her 14, going into her shirt factory, and this brave young woman crying her eyes out with fear and completely lost. And not everybody was good to her, you know, certainly among the other workers, but some were. She never forgot that. And when she was in the factory, she made a point, and I believe this is true, she made an absolute point that when a young one would come in, she would mind her.
Yeah.
And mind her fiercely and teach her how to hold her ground.
And of course, we forget as well that secondary education was not an option for most people on this island.
We were the first generation in my family to have any chance of a secondary education, let alone a third education. We were the absolute first.
So before you, you came from a line of blacksmiths on one side and seamen on the other side, is that right?
My father's family, they did fish, but my grandfather, McGinnis, was a pretty nifty businessman. He had the story was that he came over from Fannet, where his family were, on the other side of Loch Swilly. They came over with a box of herring and started from there, and he ended up with three businesses. He passed on that to one of my uncles, not to all of them, but he passed on that skill in selling and in business. My mother's family, they were blacksmiths up until my uncle Seamus would have been the last. But my grandfather was a working blacksmith, and my mother remembered both her grandfather and great-grandfather. And there was a forge. I was born over a forge in my grandmother's house. So that was functioning up until the 1950s. That was where we came from.
Yeah.
We had no land. We had no contact with farming or anything else, actually. But we always had pride and skill. And the last of the blacksmiths, my Uncle Seamus, he eventually went to work in a factory, and he became the best shirt cutter in the business, actually. I mean, everybody knew that nobody could touch him, Seamus O'Donnell. So it was weird the way it went from the iron and steel to the cloth, but they could do it. And I'm very proud of that artisan skill, that they beat something off themselves when they had it.
But very important to your mother that you would get the education. When did you have an inkling you might be a writer?
I think it was when I was about very young enough, actually. I used to have this imaginary world where I had imaginary card games and I had imaginary music. And I was about 10.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it started to get substance, but it all had to be done in code and in secret. I would be very ashamed and shocked if anybody had been able to crack the code.
Really?
And sometimes people tried, but I never give it away. So I burrowed away in secret, as I say, and tried my best to hide what I was doing. I finally, when I was about 14 or 15, we were going around a classroom in the secondary school, and the people were asking, what do you want to be? And, you know, it was like teachers and I said, a writer. And I thought that the teacher was going to soil himself, that somebody had said that, actually. and it couldn't have happened to a better man.
So then you headed off to Dublin to college. Was that a huge liberation then, or terrifying?
I had never spent a day away from Buncrana in my life.
No way.
Not a day. I had never spent... We used to go on our holidays. We lived at 38 Marion Park, and our cousins, the O'Hares, lived at 35 Marion Park, and we used to go on holidays to each other's houses. With mostly my poor cousin Kathleen crying in the middle of the night to come back to her own house.
Yeah.
My father went to see what could he do. And Kathleen said, it's the wallpaper. I'm not used to the wallpaper. And my father said, well, Pat, I'm not getting out paper and paste and starting now at 5 a.m. But that was the extent of our travels, 3 doors down, 3 doors up. And then I had to come to Dublin. But I was determined to come and to do it.
Okay, so your next choice, I think this kind of brings us to your next song choice. Lisa O'Neill, Come Back, Paddy Riley.
Yes. Well, Lisa, I don't know Lisa, but I met her once briefly in America. Eugene Downs, that wonderful organiser, was doing something for Cultural Ireland, and she was there. And she's a lovely woman, and that voice, which is all the wisdom of every lake and cavern in it. She's singing the song which my grandmother used to sing. And one of my grandmother's great joys was the fact that of all her many children, only one had to emigrate. My Uncle Tommy had to go to Scotland, like a lot of Donegal people. And I always remember the terrible grief, the joy of him arriving back and the terrible grief of him going. And this song, I think, Percy French, whom I revere, has it. He knows what he's writing about, and Lisa knows what she's singing about.
Okay, this is Frank McGuinness, the second choice. Lisa O'Neill, Come Back, Paddy Reilly.
I look down the street that very first morn and give a great crow of delight. See most newborn babies appear in a hut and start with a song. The baby's a man now, he's toil-worn and tough, still whispers, come over the sea. Come back, Paddy Reilly, to Bally James Duff. Oh, come home, Paddy Reilly, to me.
There you go, that's the wisdom of all the lakes and cavern there. Lisa O'Neill, Come Back, Paddy Reilly. Frank McGuinness, the second choice today. So, Frank, you had big success and acclaim kind of early on with Factory Girls, and then observed the Sons of Ulster marching to the Somme. Did you enjoy the early success?
Yes, very much. Loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Were you the toast of the town, yeah?
I'm told I was, but I didn't realise that at the time. And I mean, it's Dublin. When you're the toast of the town, they also they're burning effigies. So I had from the first go, I knew it was kind of a double-edged or a double flame. But I felt an enormous relief. The first time David Marcus accepted a poem for the Irish Press, New Irish Writing, that was like an unbelievable awakening that you're doing the right thing. You are taking the right decision to do this.
So many people mention him as a guy who mentored people.
Oh, yeah, and Camir, glorious man.
What's the job of good theatre?
Well, I think that at the time, Joe Dowling was running the Abbey, Sean McCarthy was the literary manager, and the mighty Patrick Mason was the a resident director. And I was very, very lucky to have those three men in the cosmos of Irish writing at the time. Patrick is just a world-class director, and if he has faith in you, you're going to do your best work, you're going to try to do your best work. But I found it with playwriting, actually, that it's very demanding. It's very, very sore. And the more you do it, the harder it gets, in a way. So at the beginning, it was glorious to go in there and just tackle what you wanted to tackle, but bit by bit it became clear you were carrying a responsibility of the play, of the actors, the company, and indeed of the theatre if you were in the Abbey.
And should you be causing trouble? Should a playwright be causing trouble or annoying some people?
Well, if they want to, if they decide that's their forte, then you go out and do it. But at the same time, what you're really responsible for is your own play. And you have to write as good a play and as demanding a play as any other. And it should be more demanding of yourself than any other political cause or any other nonsense. You've got to do it on your own.
Would you say Irish theatre was it more vital then than it might be now?
Well, at least then the theatres were open. It's shocking that for the past 6-7 months, it's pretty hard to see a play in this town. That is a hell of an indictment of something, whatever it may be. I know everybody's doing their best to cope with what money they have. But Jesus, when I was writing, there were two plays on at the Abbey. There was a play on at the Gate. there was a thriving independent scene in the Gaiety, possibly in the Olympia. Druid were starting out, then they were doing new writing as well as the sings. So there was opportunity to write. There was a chance to write and to write a varied type of play.
Yeah. Okay.
Now I think that would be very hard to do. Sons of Ulster wouldn't be done now if I come in with it. It wouldn't be performed. Factor Girls might be, but the Sons of Ulster wouldn't be because it's too demanding.
Okay.
And it breaks my heart to say it. And it's, you know, I don't know, it's nobody's fault. It's just that's the way things evolve.
Yeah,
nothing's
I think a lot
same.
Of them feel they're caught up in doing paperwork for grants and this and that, and they
bonkers.
Don't have their...
I mean, absolute
yeah.
bonkers.
Tell me about your next choice, Otis Redding, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Well, I tried when I was putting these down to choose as many great voices as I could, and this man is, to me, the voice of a prophet, if not the voice of the divine. I heard it when I was 14, and I didn't really know the meaning of loss and sorrow. But by God, Otis Redding lets me know what it is to feel grief. I think everybody has their own definition of what's the blues and what do they mean. But to me, it's Otis singing this song, and in particular, the whistling at the end.
Yeah, okay. Frank McGuinness's third choice, Otis Redding, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Listen, sitting here resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. Listen, 2,000 miles I roam just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
We got the whistling. I agree with you. Isn't it extraordinary in a whistle?
Yeah.
There's acceptance, sadness. It's extraordinary how we did that.
All the birds dying.
Yeah. You came out in your 30s, would have been the 80s, right? Modern Ireland.
Oh, I was out well before that, actually.
What?
I was out well before.
Oh,
that.
Then the new.
With a question of who to. No, you had to watch yourself, actually. But,
did you, yeah?
You know, I mean, I certainly, I lived with my partner, Philip, since 1979. So we're a long time together. It just was wise not to trust everybody who came looking for endorsements. A lot of them were closet kisses themselves, and I wasn't going to help them out by telling about me. I was going to keep my mouth shut. But I certainly would have no qualms about being gay and admit nothing. I mean, openly declare it.
Yeah. Did you feel oppressed by Irish society in Ireland then?
How could you not be, actually? Yeah. I mean, you have to remember, it was, I think, 1997 that Maura Geoghegan Quinn got the bit between her teeth, came out and said, that's it, the law is changing. We're not having referendums, we're not having consultations, we're changing it. More power to her. She did what Donoghue O'Malley did in the 60s when he said, right, that's it. There's going to be free second and third level education. And that was the way, from Fianna Fáil, both parties, but that was the way they actually ruled wisely. I mean, they just did not care who they were going to offend or who the endorsement they had.
And there were no judicial changes or this or that. Yeah, yeah. Did it change your relationship with your family?
My family really didn't know that I was gay, or it was all underhand, all secretive. It was a terrible thing to admit, but that was the way it was, actually. And it's why I despise...
So your parents never knew?
My mother, I told her, yes. And my father, I think he had a pretty good idea, actually. He did meet my partner, and they got on well. But when the campaign for marriage reform or marriage, right to marriage, my family were extraordinarily supportive and on the side of the right side. You know, they've made no doubt how much they wanted to pass, every one of them, actually. And they would come from a very devout Catholic background. They would come from a very observant background. But they knew that this was a vicious law, a terrible law. And my feeling about my main gripe with the Catholic Church was, I know that the Vatican would only have a say about, you know, acceptance, but what the Catholic Church should have been in the foreground of was changing the law, changing the civil law. That's what could have saved their reputation if they'd come out on that.
On compassion.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about your next choice, Joni Mitchell, The Last Time I Saw Richard.
This, I know, Joni I worship, actually. As a lyricist, she's incomparable. She is so wise, so terse. She says what she has to say. And this is from the Blue album, which is one of my favourites. But what I love this song is that I think everybody somewhere in their life has a Richard out to ruin you. And you need to be very careful of the Richards of this world.
Okay.
And anybody who could, you know, come up to the line about, you know, married a figure skater and he bought her a refrigerator, she's okay with me.
Okay. Joni Mitchell, The Last Time I Saw Richard.
The last time I saw Richard was Detroit in 68, and he told me all romantics meet the same fate someday. Cynical and drunk and boring someone in some dark cafe. You laugh, he said, you think you're immune. Go look at your eyes, they're full of moon. You like roses and kisses and pretty men to tell you all those pretty.
That's Joni Mitchell, The Last Time I Saw Richard, and that's the playwright Frank McGuinness's fourth choice today. Frank, you're 71 now. Apart from the writing getting harder, are you feeling age, or how are you dealing with it?
Yeah, I mean, the body's kind of winding down a bit, actually. I mean, I'm finding aches and pains are more pronounced. But as there's nothing more boring than other people's aches and pains, I live with it.
But you're okay with it? Yeah.
I'm okay at the minute, actually. I have to watch myself. And I mean, I've a lot more appointments than I used to have, you know, which is rather tiresome. But anyway, I'm battling through, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And you have a lifelong love there next to you, though, which must make...
Yes, Philip is there. We've been there, as I say, nearly 50 years. So it's good to have that,
Yeah. And listen, before we finish up, my condolences on the death of your friend Marianne Faithfull.
So yes, you,
she was a great friend of yours, and you collaborated as well.
We did, actually. And she loved living in Ireland. Marianne was an extraordinary woman. There were two Mariannes. There was the one that everybody knows, the horrendous history. And then there was this lion who protected her privacy with... an intensity that I cannot ever match or ever have ever met before. Her life was music. I really only got to know her when I saw her with her band and controlling what was going to happen in the music. And her knowledgeability about music was second to none. You know, she was not Mick Jagger's girlfriend when she was in front of a band.
Yeah.
She was her own woman, and she knew what she was going to get. And it was a pleasure to work with her.
She what gave did me you a, do with her?
We did the Throppney Opera at the Gate, Brecht's Throppney Opera.
Yeah.
And she did the songs from that, the woman's songs from that.
Of course, she's perfect for that.
Oh, she was.
That's her.
She's great at it. But she also, we worked together. I mean, I got a chance to work with people like Angelo Baldamente, who's David Lynch's composer. We did an album with him. And I worked with Lou Reed, and one song.
Did you?
Yeah, and Daniel Lanois wrote some songs with me and her. So, I mean, there's not many play. I know McGregor, I know Conor McPherson did the Bob Dylan and yeah. Enda Welsh did the Bowie.
Yeah.
I got Lou Reed.
Yeah.
You know, so, but anyway.
Absolutely, it was the scariest of them all, but at the same time.
I didn't meet him.
Okay.
But anyway, it was great to see I'd have met him, I'd done work with him. I think he was frightened of her, actually. She did make people very afraid.
I can well imagine.
When she chose the old imperial Habsburg tradition.
Yeah, exactly.
Came out.
Yeah, yeah.
No fear
bit of Austrian aristocracy there. your final choice is Les Negres Vertes. I love Paris.
Yeah.
Do you?
I adore it. I haven't been there for too long, but I just want to hear this. Oh no, I have to say Paris. Je t'adore. I was so proud of them at the Olympics, you know, turning that great city, that mighty, sorrowful, triumphant city, refusing to bow down to all bullying. It's Paris. And yes, I love Paris.
Okay. And before we play, what are you up to?
I got a new book of poems coming in May. Got a new play with the Abbey early next year. And I hope to finish in a full-length play over the next few months. Looking forward to Easter in Donegal.
Frank McGuinness, this has been one of the great privileges of recent times. I enjoyed that so much. Listening to Frank McGuinness on your show at the moment, an insight into the brilliance of his mind and writing. He's magnificent and interesting. And there's a hello from the McGuinnesses in Buncrana. Lovely to hear you on the radio this Sunday morning. All politics is local, isn't it?
Yes.
Frank McGuinness, thank you so much. That
was
terrific. And we'll finish up on Frank's final choice. This is Les Negres Vertes, I Love Paris.
I love Paris in the spring.